Welcome back as we continue to explore leadership together and what that means. You'll notice the title of this session, Things to Know About Change. If you're going to have a vision and you're going to lead people to that vision, to the accomplishment of that vision and the fulfillment of that vision, there is going to have to be change. We've talked about many of them. You know, sometimes it's changes in personnel. Sometimes it's changes in facility. But there's a variety of kinds of change. Change in hierarchy in the system. People leaving, people coming, all kinds of change. You need to know about change theory. But just as a reminder, this is what we've been talking about for a long time now. The leader interacts with the culture, which is how we do things here, to develop a vision for the future, something that's going to guide them into the future, and then provides the impetus to do the prayer and the planning that's necessary for that future to become a reality. That's what we're talking about. Now, change. As we talk about prayer and planning, leading change is important. Now, there was an old style of change, which I read about when I was early in ministry, and I didn't know a whole lot about leadership at that time. And so I read a book, and it was by the person who was called today, at that time was called the leading church consultant in America. And he talked about change, and we were going through a time where we needed to make some changes. We had decided in the church I was serving in California that we need to change our worship service. The church was welcoming and wanted to make an impact in its community, but its worship style was old time, pretty much. You know, we sang from the hymnal. In fact, in my tradition, we had an order of service that at one time was declared to be the norm for every church in the denomination, so that if you went anywhere in my denomination, you'd get the same order of worship. And it was a dialogic kind of experience. In other words, we'd have a call to worship at the beginning, where God would speak and invite us into worship together, or the pastor would speak from Scripture and invite us into worship. Come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, or some such verse. An invitation, a call to be worshiping, and then we would respond as people with a song of praise. That was the first song, and it was out of the hymnal. Church I was serving at that time had two hymnals, so one was a little more up-to-date than the other, but we'd sing some song of praise out of one of those hymnals. And then there would be a time when God would speak again to us, and He would speak about His will through the Word. And in my tradition, we read the Ten Commandments every single week. I don't know why. I don't know who thought that was a good idea. But we talked about that being the will of God for our lives and a teacher of our own sin. And so then we would respond to God's word. We'd respond by a hymn of penitence. And then we'd be led in what was called the congregational prayer, the long prayer, ongoing response. We would give an offering, and we'd have a song before the message. And then the message, which is God speaking to us, and we'd respond in song again. And then there'd be a benediction at the end where God would speak to us and say, "The Lord bless you and keep you, make His face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift His countenance upon you and give you peace." And we were done. A wonderful theory. But when we had done our study of the community around us, we found that that kind of worship was no longer relevant to them. In fact, we played the organ mostly. Occasionally, we would have a piano join that organ. We thought that was pretty progressive. But as we interacted with our community and began asking questions out there, we found that the only place they hear the organ played is in a ball stadium. And the only time they sing along with an organ is in the seventh inning stretch, where they start singing, "Take me out to the ball game. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. You know, I don't care if I ever get back." That was their experience with organ. And so we decided that we had to make a move to more contemporary kind of worship. The kind of worship that was led with instruments that people were familiar with. Guitars, drums, keyboards, that sort of thing. Well, I read this book on change, and it said, you know, you've got to unfreeze the status quo in order to make significant change. And then after you unfreeze the status quo, there's going to be a period of chaos. And in that chaos, you begin to choose those things that are going to become the new frozen status quo. So it was, in many ways, a good idea. But we had been in this process for a long time when I realized that we hadn't unfrozen the status quo. We had at the beginning, introduced at the beginning of the worship, a praise time where we had a praise team led with a variety of instruments that we could could supply. And, you know, that was two or three songs. And some people hated them. They called them the choruses back then. This is in the late 1980s. And, you know, and people would mock them, saying, you know, what kind of songs do you sing in church? Well, Mary, come home, Mary, come home. The sheep are in the meadow, the sheep are in the meadow, the sheep are in the meadow. We got to move them to the barn. I mean, I heard that kind of thing back. People didn't like them. Some didn't. And so there was this pressure back. And so I began to realize that, you know, something more had to be done if we were actually going to change the overall character of our worship. And so I read this book. We've got to unfreeze the status quo. And what usually does that? We're going to talk about crisis in a moment. Crisis does it. And so I decided to create a crisis. I invited a worship team from a church that was almost Pentecostal. It was the pastor who was somebody I was working with because they were going to plant a daughter church on our behalf. Somebody I'd been working with, he had grew up as a Pentecostal. And so he had this tend toward Pentecostal worship, which for us was something to be appreciated, but only at a distance. And so I invited him and his team to come lead worship. It was shocking to folks. We had people walking out. We had one or two that didn't ever come back because they could see the right handwriting on the wall. And talk about unfreezing the status quo. People were upset. And the good thing is, by the next week, what we had been doing looked very tame by comparison. And so some of the complaints stopped. But I think I caused unneeded anguish on the part of some people, and unneeded conflict that had to be managed after that. Well, since that time, the late 1980s, there's been a lot of study on change. And one of the best-known people to do this study is a man named John Cotter. Now, John Cotter is a picture of him. At the age of 33, he became a professor in the business school at Harvard University. And he has held that position ever since, and he's gotten honor after honor. He's written many books. The book I'm going to be basing this lecture and the next one on is called Leading Change. He studied all kinds of organizations and tried to quantify what goes on in a corporation or a business or a nonprofit, what goes on when they do successful change. And then he tried to put that down into a formula which has been used over and over and over again. And I hope you find it helpful. It's been very helpful to me as I've looked at the various components that need to be in place if I'm going to change things successfully on the way to fulfillment of the vision. So here are the 8 steps. He says there are these 8 steps, and you can't skip any of them. He says if you try to skip one, it's going to make the change short-term instead of long-term, and it may end up with the change blowing up, you know. His mind blew up. In fact, there was one person I remember who used to stand with his arms folded any time we were singing any song that wasn't out of the approved hymnal for the denomination, and he would sit there and just be quiet, and then he would sing lustily when we were singing. I mean, it was that kind of conflict. So what do you need to do to initiate meaningful change? Well, step one is establish a sense of urgency, that people have to know there's a reason for the change, and the reason is compelling. Secondly, create a guiding coalition. You can't do it alone. Develop a vision and a strategy. We talked a good deal about that, so I don't want to add into that. And communicating the change vision, and then empowering for broad-based action. In other words, you empower people to make decisions. You don't try to make a funnel for decisions that only you as the leader or only a select few leaders can make decisions. You generate short-term wins that demonstrate that the change is working. You consolidate gains and produce more change, and then you anchor the new approach in the culture. Those are the 8 steps. Now, today we're going to look more detail at 1 through 5, and then in the next lecture we'll look at 6, 7, and 8 and a couple of other thoughts about change. So, first of all, first step is establishing a sense of urgency. Now, this is absolutely essential if people are going to change. And it can't be made up. It can't be something that you're trying to create that people feel is this makes it urgent and other things are not urgent. It can't be made up. It can't be faked. It's got to be a real urgency based on defining reality in the present. What are the things that you see that require change? Now, they can be facing a problem, that you've got a problem that you've got to overcome, or it can be, we've got this tremendous opportunity, and if we don't grab it now, we're going to miss that. And so, you know, for us in that first church, it was a mixture that we've got this problem. We are not relevant to our community, but we've also got this opportunity of moving to this new community where there's going to be 150,000 people moving in, and the harvest is going to be great, and the fields are white unto harvest. We've got to go there. That's a genuine kind of sense of urgency. But this is very tricky, because many people will say they sense the urgency, and they won't. In fact, here's a quote from Cotter as he reflects on this complacency or power to stay where you are. He said, "I cannot count the number of times I have heard an executive claim that all of the people on his or her management team recognize the need for major change, only to discover myself that half of that team thinks the status quo really isn't so bad." So the sense of urgency is necessary. Now, what creates complacency? It's helpful to understand that as you start thinking about how am I going to overcome complacency. Here are the things that create a sense of complacency or happiness with the status quo. We'll start at the top. The absence of a major and visible crisis. Some people just don't see it. You know, I've talked before about Tom Rainer and going into churches, and they don't see it. They've seen this gradual decline. They haven't seen a major change in their church, and so as far as they know, things are okay, and they aren't eager to change things. And it's a powerful thing, especially if all the bills are being paid. We'll talk about that in just a second. So if there isn't an obvious crisis, or at least one that you're talking to people about, they're going to be complacent. They like it the way it is. The way things are is because people like it the way it is, and they don't want to change. Going around clockwise, too many visible resources. That can be a problem, because it can keep people from grabbing on to the urgency about change. If you don't have enough, people feel a sense of urgency, but if you have too much, they can feel okay. You've seen this probably with offerings. In fact, I've been reading a book lately by a man that's called Unstuck. All of a sudden the man's name escapes me, but he talks about a danger point, particularly in churches. He's a consultant for churches. And he says there's a danger point when he said enough money is coming in to cover the budget. He said, but the number of new people coming into the church is about dried up. He said, that's a time when he said, I can predict with accuracy that a huge percentage of churches like that are going to die because they don't sense the urgency to change. The bills are being met. Low overall performance standards. Boy, that's a tough one in the church, isn't it? Now, in a company, that's easy. Hopefully, there's a structure in a company where there are regular evaluations that are done. There are performance goals that are set. And if those aren't met, there are things that have to be done. And the person has to meet these new goals, has to go through some kind of training or something like that. But in the church, we tend to do a variety of things that encourage low performance standards. One of the things we do is we hire the wrong people. We'll talk about that later as we talk about building our team. But who do you hire when a church has a need? Often, at least in my church experience, we offer a job to a person who's available. Now, in most cases, if somebody's going to work part-time, they have to be one of a few kinds of people. One, they're usually homemakers, mothers, who maybe had a career before they began motherhood, but they took time off for motherhood, and now their kids are getting older and they want to get back into the work world. And so a part-time position at church is ideal for them. Now, sometimes you get some of those people who are wonderfully motivated, who've got training, who are professionals, but sometimes they're not. And so we hope that we can develop them, but we put up with low standards as a result. The other place that you get people who want to work part-time are from the retired community. People who are done with their work world and they're a little bored and they want to get back into it. And sometimes you can get really qualified people who want to take things further, but often you get people who are slowing down their life. And that creates complacency because there are low overall standards. Organizational structures that focus employees on narrow functional goals. This is a function of you as a leader and the leaders around you. That often in the church world or in the Christian world, in the nonprofit world, we create job descriptions that are focused on tasks. In other words, we want you to come in and we want you to do these lectures. We want you, every Sunday, we want you to do a class for the middle school group in our church. And we want you once in a while to do something that will gather them to do fellowship, and that's your job. Unfortunately, it's not a vision-based job. A vision-based job would say, we want you to look at middle school, and we want you to find the best ways to disciple middle schoolers into faith so that they come to profess faith. They're baptized if they haven't been. They profess their faith if they've been baptized. We want our middle school community to be humming with the Holy Spirit, and we want you to look at how to do that and tell us how to do that. That's a whole different approach to jobs than, oh, we need this job done. We need these people recruited for leaders. We need these people done for this. That creates complacency because people could say, well, I'm doing my job. I'm doing my job. Internal measurement systems that focus on the wrong performance indexes. In other words, how do you decide what is success? In the church world, it's often if the money is coming in adequate to meet the budget needs. And we fail to look beyond that. And there are a whole lot of other things we should be looking at in the church. Not just is the money coming in, but how's church attendance? What are the trends there? Are people growing in faith? How do we find that out? And how can we learn from them whether people are growing in their experience of faith or not? Are people serving? Are they living out their life in a variety of ways, in their community, in their neighborhoods? And are they serving in the church ministry in various places? We could check service, all kinds of things we could check. But we tend to focus on one or two things. In fact, you know, it used to be ABCs, attendance, bucks, and, you know, community. We just look at whether they're there or not. So, that creates complacence. A lack of sufficient performance feedback from external sources. You know, if you measure yourself by yourself, you're always going to come up really well. There's an old story about a kid who came to his dad and said, I'm 8 feet tall. The kid was 10 years old. He said, 8 feet tall? How did you figure out you're 8 feet tall? Well, he made his own ruler. And so he measured himself by his own ruler, and by his ruler, he was 8 feet tall and ready to take on Goliath. It helps greatly to get an external source. We're going to talk about getting consultants in or people from outside just to give an objective view of what you're doing in ministry. A kill the messenger of bad news, low candor, low confrontation culture. People who aren't used to confrontation, who aren't used to people coming and saying, hey, you're not doing your job. Those kind of people in charge, the people who aren't confrontational in that kind of area, are going to contribute to complacency because it seems like everything is okay. And then there's human nature with its capacity for denial, especially if people are already busy or stressed, and they usually are. And then too much happy talk from senior management. In other words, we don't really want to see problems, so we just talk about how great things are where we are. All of these kind of things are sources of complacency, and the only way to overcome them is to create a sense of urgency. So how do you do that? Well, crisis can play a big role. Again, can't be a made-up crisis. It can't be one where you cry wolf and turns out there is no wolf. You know the story of that, or the kid who cries wolf and there's no wolf and he laughs because everybody buys into his challenge, his sense of urgency, and then there's no wolf and finally there is a wolf and he cries wolf and nobody will respond because they've been used to hearing the cry and responding by not responding. And so they've gotten into that. Well, that happens within the church. If you cry too often, a sense of urgency, people are going to start tuning you out, especially if it turns out that there's not a crisis. Now again, the crisis can be one of two kinds. It can be opportunity out there, or it can be problems internally. I'll talk about that a little bit more in just a moment. Keeping the big picture in mind. In other words, reminding people of your vision, reminding people of the opportunity that exists where we are, that you become the person who's communicating the big picture. I help them look at long-term history. Now, long-term history can be a huge help in that, because if people look back, they're not looking at the immediate, but they're looking back, they can remember a time often when things were better. I was in a small group once with a group of leaders from my denomination and in regional churches, and we were just sharing what's going on in our churches. And we began talking about what are the signs of things have just drifted a bit. And one man just shared about how his church was dying, and they realized it. Said the average age is over 70. Says, but, you know, we don't have any expenses. We own our building. We have to heat it. We pay somebody to come in to preach. They didn't have a pastor. Says, we just love each other. And the last person that is alive is going to just shut the door and lock it, turn off the lights, and the church will be done. And what a sad thing. But as we talked about the past, what was that church like once? And once upon a time, it was vibrant with people coming to faith, children growing up, it vibrant. Same thing happened. Somebody else in the group says, you know, I'm just thinking. And I'm thinking about our boys' ministry. And we used to have 30 kids there, and now we've only got like 5 or 6. And our choir. I look at our choir, and we used to be this multi-generational experience of praise to God and enthusiastic about it. Now, he said, the average age is probably over 60. And so if you get people looking back, you can say, wow, things have changed. If they look just at the immediate past, they won't see it. They just won't see it. Andy Stanley refers to it as the old couch syndrome. You know, where you've got an old couch in your living room, and because you have it there and it's aged with you, and you haven't even noticed it aging because it was so gradual, you just get used to it. And so getting long-term history will help people see, wait a minute, that couch is pretty beat up. And if it's going to be functional, I've got to find a different way of doing my couch. You can bring in consultants. That's helpful when somebody from outside, an external source, comes in and said, look, I've been looking at your church, and here's what I've noticed. I found that to be, at times, incredibly energizing toward a new vision. And I'm somebody who fought that. I thought, boy, I've got this great education. You know, I have a doctor's degree. I know what's wrong. And so I should be able to be the one who's the prophet. But I found that a prophet in his own country is not often honored, as Jesus said. And to have somebody else come in with expertise from outside and say, you know what, you should be thinking about these things. And then another way to overcome complacency is to bombard people with future opportunities as well as the present problems. In other words, let people see that there's something better. And when we talk about communicating the vision, you know, we've got to define how there is better than here. And so we say, wow, you know, there's opportunity out there. And so we can create a sense of urgency toward it. Now, I just want to give you a couple of examples of, you know, how this might work. I showed you this graph before with the church, and you'll notice that it shrunk from about 450 people total in worship on a Sunday to a little over 150. So you've got a two-thirds drop in worship attendance and membership over a period of 15 years. Now, a lot of questions come up when you see a graph like this. Like you say, what in the world happened between 2006 and 2007 that there was that kind of drop anyway? And you might hear about a variety of crises. You might hear about problems. And then there was that pickup time after that, 2007 to 2008, 2008 to 2009, where there's growth again, and then down, except for, you know, 2014 to 15. There was a brief up blip before the downward trend picked up again. Now, I did not consult with this church, but I did consult with the pastor. And I looked at this graph with him and I said, you are dying. You're dying. You've got to be thinking about this. Your church does not have a long life unless something major changes. And so he went back to his church and he shared that message. We're dying. And they began talking about a strategic plan that would turn things around. But talk about killing the messenger. That church, a year and a half later, basically fired its pastor. They didn't want to grapple with it because it came up not in the context of God's vision for them, but in the context of, we've just got to solve this problem. How do we get more people here? Instead of the problem of, that they had lost their vision of people coming to faith and growing in faith. So, that's one. Here's another church. This was Totals. I'm doing a consulting thing with a group of churches, of which that one is a part. In our area, in our denomination, we have the Synod, which is over all the denomination in one sense, and then classes are the regional representatives. Well, I'm on a team that's looking at this particular classes to talk about, you know, what's them like. And this is the graph for all the churches put together. And you'll notice again, the trend is down. And so, you know, we're trying to figure out, our team, how do we create a sense of urgency in a group of churches, of about 22 churches, how do we create a sense of urgency that will allow us to change together what we're doing as well as individually within the church. But part of the urgency comes from look what's happening and then showing churches what's happening in their own congregations. So, going the wrong way, sorry. Wait a minute, something's wrong with my... Okay, number two, excuse me, creating a guiding coalition. Now, you may think that all you've got to do because you're a leader is sit down and identify the problems and create a strategy for creating urgency, etc., but that's not accurate. You need more than one person doing this. You need a group of people who have influence. Remember when we were defining leadership, one of the definitions was having influence with people. And so you need a guiding coalition that are going to work through these steps of change with you and with the congregation. Because the reality is, there are going to be people who are going to be more influential than you in bringing people along with the change. So you're looking for people. Who do you get? Well, you get people who have positional power. There are people who are chosen in one way or another, maybe as elders in your church or presbyters or whatever you call them, or your business. There are people who are in charge in this nonprofit or whatever. You've got to get some of them on this guiding coalition, one or two, so that there is communication between the official power and what you are presenting as far as change goes. Because if there isn't, you'll find automatic kickback that if the people who are in positional power are after, find out things after they're decided, they're going to immediately raise up their walls of defensiveness. And so you have people who have positional power on your guiding coalition. You have some people who have expertise. I was really excited when we were going through change, and one of the people that I found out about just through conversation, a quiet guy, but turns out he had a PhD in chemistry, but his passion was statistics. And so I gave him all the numbers from our church going back like 15, 20 years and said, now, you know, put this together and tell me what you can learn from statistics. And when he was ready, we got a small group together just to look at these and hear his reflections. And it was magnificent. He had charts and graphs and all this stuff that I wouldn't have ever thought of. But he had expertise that allowed us to see a variety of things happening in children's ministry, in youth ministry, in each worship service that we had, and what happened when we started a second worship service, and was able to identify a variety of things that otherwise I couldn't see. He had expertise. Credibility. You look for people who have credibility. Many people are not in positional power, but they have power in the congregation because they are people who are recognized as leaders. They are trusted. They are looked to. They are sought for their advice. These people are marvelous to have with you because they'll often carry the ball for you. You don't have to be the one always pushing the change. You'll be somebody who's part of a team who's doing that and people of influence who are helping you do that. Yeah, I learned this as I was learning leadership when I had a great new vision for our church. We were experiencing growth, and so I decided that, you know, one of the things we should consider was becoming a church that's planting daughter churches. And so I rammed this through. It wasn't in the budget. And I just ran through proposals about how we could get this done, with how we could get the money together, why we should do it. And I didn't talk to anybody about it until I finally presented it to the elders. And, you know, I was a person who had a lot of leadership chips stored up at that point. I had credibility with them. And so they approved it, and it went on, even though there were some questions, some reservations on the part of some. And I remember one of the persons who was not in official leadership at that time heard about it as we just announced it to the congregation, that our goal now was to be taking people, leaders in, letting them do a fishing expedition in our church for people to go with them out to a nearby community and plant a new church, that was part of it. And he said, you know, we've got to have lunch. So he took me to lunch. He said, you got what you wanted this time. That was incredible leadership. He said, but, he said, you're carrying it all. He said, if you trust some of us, we can carry the ball with you a long way. You don't have to be the only one identified with this. He said, but if you keep doing it your own way, he says, pretty soon the leaders among us are going to be abandoning you because they weren't consulted. And they may have reasons that you haven't seen. And so you've got to consult. Those are the kind of people you get on board. And I was really pleased. This man lives in California. I had a telephone conversation with him last week because we still keep in touch on a regular basis. And he's now in his 80s, and he was just asked by the church to chair another building program. He chaired the 6.5-year process of our relocation. And now in his 80s, he's still going, and he knows he's got credibility, and so he's still there. You look for people like that. You look for people who have leadership qualities. Not everybody has to be a leader, but you look for some who are going to be people who are going to take part of the task list and carry them out. They're going to be people who are going to see the vision and be able to mold that vision with you. And the common thing about them is that they will have a common goal, and that is to build the kingdom of God where you are. So we've looked at establishing a sense of urgency, creating a guiding coalition, develop a vision and strategy. We've talked about that. Communicating the vision. We talked about that, the whole thing of how do you roll out your vision. But I just want to say here, use different forums, not just Sunday morning, not just the bulletin, not just the newsletter, but some pictures of what's going on. Use picture language examples. I'm hoping to get some people to interview here, and they're going through a major change within their two churches that are merging with a vision. They're not merging because they're in need, but they're merging because they have this common vision to make a difference in the kingdom. And they have been producing videos for their congregations that are really excellent communicators with some of the people who are on board the guiding coalition, telling about why they think this is important. Use a variety of means. Use Facebook. Use Instagram, use Messenger, use whatever you've got to use, but do it over and over again. Repeat, 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 repeat. Now, you know, I've realized about myself over the years that this is an area where I am weak, and I have to have people remind me to repeat the vision, because I figure that once I've said it, you know, and people have bought into it, we're good. Let's go, and we'll check in with you in a year. But I went to a friend's church. He's part of the network that I created of leaders that we get together every 6 weeks just to talk about leadership things in our churches. And I was just incredibly impressed when I went to his church. I know that they speak of their vision for ministry as bridging the bayou. Now, what they mean there is that right next to the church is the poorest group of people in our entire area. It's a trailer park. These people are under the poverty level, or they're in the Alice category, which means they're employed, but they can't make enough money in their employment to actually meet the standard of living for the community. So you've got this poor place right next to the church. And around the corner, since we live on the shores of Lake Michigan and Spring Lake, there's a bayou from Spring Lake where there are homes that are worth $1 million+. And so their goal as a church is to bridge the bayou, to bring these two groups together, to have these producing resources and people in order to reach these people and do that in creative ways, and they've created a lot of strategies for that. So that's the simple statement of their vision. So I go to their worship service, and it was a delightful experience because in that worship, there were four different people that verbalized the vision. One guy was just making some announcements. I don't know if he was an official person or not, but he was making announcements. Another man was praying. The worship leader, who was a woman, mentioned it a couple of times in introductions to songs. And then when the pastor got up, he began to talk about the fact that we've got this thing, we've got to be thankful for these people in the church because they're heroes, and began to call out people who had lived out part of the vision. Repeat, 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 repeat. You can think you've said it enough, and when you think you've said it enough, you haven't. Repeat again the vision. So, number five, you empower for broad-based action. Now, this can be a challenge for some leaders because we like to control things. And so we've got to look at the barriers that exist to a broad-based empowerment for action. In other words, generally speaking, you should have decisions made at the lowest level of your organization possible. So often, controlling leaders like to, control every decision, so they become a bottleneck. So what keeps us from empowering people to make decisions? The corporations have learned this. I heard a talk by the former CEO of Home Depot here in the United States. It's an incredible organization. It's a home improvement place where you can go and buy whatever you need to fix your home or to expand it or to build a new house or whatever. You can get the lumber, the electronics, the kitchen stuff, the doors, the plumbing, all of it in one place. Well, it's been a successful business. And when he was asked, why is it successful? One of the reasons he gave was that they've empowered their associates. They don't call their people employees. They call them associates. They're associates in the company. And he said, every one of them is empowered to make a customer happy. In other words, up to $150, they can make the decision right there. If they're talking to somebody who's brought back a tool and it didn't work, make it right now. Up to $150 before you have to get somebody higher in order to solve it. That's the kind of empowerment I'm talking about within an organization, to be able to make the decision now. So what stops that? Well, formal structures make it difficult to act. We're in the 12 o'clock position there. Often that comes through the job descriptions. Often, as I said, when we write job descriptions, we make them task-oriented. Now, what a difference when we stop doing that and we try to encourage and develop our staff to be more leader-conscious, and we began taking away job descriptions, and instead we created a quarterly ministry action plans, or MAPs. That's what an employee was working off from. Ministry action plans, not a job description where they could say, oh, I did that, I did that, I did that. And the change for some people was incredible. I shared with you about Special Treasures, our program for children and adults who have developmental needs, who are special. And the woman who's in charge of that was somebody who caught on to this. Now, we could have written her job description. We could have created the structure so that, you're responsible for making sure that there is a partner with each kid on the autism scale in our Sunday school program. And, you should do something that equips these parents and gives people. We could have made a whole list of things that this person could do. But instead, we said, figure out what we have to do this well. We know that there are 8%, as I said before, 8% of the people who have a child with special needs don't go to church or go to church in our community. That means 92% don't. Figure out what we got to do to make a program that will meet their needs. And so her mind just began thinking, and the program began to morph and change, and there are things that are being added to it because she's not thinking along the lines of tasks to do, but vision. A lack of needed skills undermines action if you go to the right. As I said, sometimes we hire the wrong people in good to great. Remember Jim Collins in the book Good to Great, talking about companies that went from good to being great companies. One of his principles of action in that process is to make sure you have the right people on the bus. If you hired wrongly, he said it's the most expensive mistake you're ever going to make because it takes so long to get rid of a person, to get a new person in, to gain the credibility for that person, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you find that the people you are working with have a lack of needed skills, they need training and you have to provide it, and if training doesn't work, then you better bite the bullet because the vision is what you're about. Bottom, 6 o'clock. Personnel and information systems make it difficult to act. It's easy to create a system where people can't get the information they need. And we realized this when we found out that there were only two people in our church who knew how to operate the database. Well, the database, information about all the people, their spiritual giftedness, where they're involved, you know, how old they are, what kind of needs they have in the family, what kind of special gifts they have that they want to be able to give to the church. All of that's in there. But 20 people couldn't access it because they didn't know how, they didn't have the skill. And so it created this bottleneck of, oh yeah, you know, I'll get you that information, but it's going to be next week. And then bosses discourage actions aimed at implementing the new vision. And in other words, bosses want to be in control. And so they want to hear every decision and they want input on every decision. These kind of things have to change in order for change to happen. People have to be empowered to make the change. And so these are the first five steps. You can't forget any of them. You take it from creating a sense of urgency to giving broad-based power to the people around you to make a difference. And that's going to help you as you go through the changes necessary for the vision to become reality. Next time, we're going to look at 6 through 8. And so come on back later.